Rishi Sunak takes the helm as the UK's new prime minister. Plus, European discount retailers rake in revenues as shoppers hunt for bargains. And pollsters are tweaking their surveys in the countdown to the US midterms, but correcting for past mistakes isn't easy.
The problem is that we don't know what the problem is. And that becomes apparent when you look at some of the hits and misses of the last few years.
It's Tuesday, October 25th. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. A leadership handover is underway in the United Kingdom this morning. New Conservative leader Rishi Sunak is expected to meet with King Charles III in order to be formally appointed as Prime Minister, becoming the first person of color and the first Hindu to lead the UK. Sunak is in the process of assembling his cabinet, and Journal reporter Paul Hannon says that markets will be closely watching his pick for Treasury Chief.
Investors are likely to be looking for the reappointment of Jeremy Hunt, who was brought in as a sort of emergency safe pair of hands by the outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss. The reappointment of Mr. Hunt would signal continuity to investors ahead of an October 31st budget announcement, which the new government hopes will settle market nerves.
Global banking giant HSBC has reported a 46% drop in profit in the third quarter compared to a year earlier, caused by the planned sale of its French retail banking business and rising provisions against credit losses. Europe's biggest bank by market value also named veteran banker George L. Hedery as its new chief financial officer, putting him in the mix as a possible successor to HSBC's top job. Meanwhile, Swiss bank UBS has reported a 24% decline in third-quarter net profit as corporate deal-making slowed and reduced consumer balances resulted in lower fee revenue. However, Journal reporter Margot Patrick says that for UBS's wealth management arm, a net inflow of $17.1 billion in new fee-generating assets is brightening long-term prospects.
So wealthy clients have existing investments that UBS helps them manage, and those declined in market value in the quarter because markets were really volatile, stocks were falling, FX was volatile too. So UBS was making less in fees off of those types of balances, but at the same time had clients deciding this is a good time to put some new money with UBS. So that was a positive sign for the future, because it means those future balances will start earning fees and that will help revenue over time.
In other market news today, tech giants Alphabet and Microsoft will report quarterly earnings, along with a host of other big names, including General Motors, Raytheon, UPS, and Visa. And men died of COVID-19 complications at a higher rate than women in both rural and urban parts of the U.S. in 2020 during the first year of the pandemic. That is according to a new federal report by the National Center for Health Statistics published Tuesday. The data revealed death rates were at least 50% higher for males compared with females, with an even greater difference between genders found in large central metropolitan areas. Scientists say there are many reasons for the disparity, including health problems such as high blood pressure and diabetes that men tend to have more often, which could lead to worse COVID-19 outcomes. From Germany to the United Kingdom, consumers are tightening their belts and increasingly shifting their purchases to discount retailers, leading to a boost in revenues for some while others are suffering. Wall Street Journal reporter Trevor Moss, who works out of our London corporate bureau, joins us now with more on this story. Hi, Trevor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
All right. So give us a quick survey, if you could, of the situation in Europe that is changing the landscape both for businesses and for consumers.
We have had a lot of economic turmoil in Europe this year ever since the invasion of Ukraine back in February. That's produced a surge in energy prices, and in turn that's caused household bills across Europe to go up significantly. The result of that is that consumer confidence is at an all-time low, according to the European Union's stats agency. They say in pretty much every country, consumers are really running scared. They're trying to spend much less money than in the past. And in particular, in the run-up to Christmas, we should expect to see spending significantly down on what we've seen in the past. A lot of spending that retailers would have been able to absorb is not going to happen. And a lot of those mass market stores are really going to struggle.
And so how are retailers responding to all of this?
Well, they're responding in many cases by offering discounts far earlier than they have in the past because they're desperate to get shoppers in through the door. And really, I think we're going to see some real pain from some of the mainstream retailers in the lead up to Christmas. And the discounters are certainly standing to benefit from that. They're getting a lot of the extra traffic.
Yeah, and it seems like some of these discount retailers are hoping the consumers that they might attract now will stick with them in the future.
That's certainly what the discounters are hoping. They've already been opening a lot of new stores. Many are saying that they're going to keep investing in stores and opening more next year. Pepco, for example, one of Europe's biggest discounters, opened over 500 stores over the last year. They're going to open 550 more next year. They're saying that they're seeing significant increases in customer traffic. They think a lot of those people are trading down from more expensive brands as they really look to make their money stretch further.
Though it would perhaps be a stretch to say it's all blue sky necessarily for discount retailers as well, right?
Discounters do have the challenge that their costs are going up the same as everyone else's costs. In that situation, you would normally like to increase prices, but they can't really do that because their customers, they demand rock bottom prices. So the discount stores are going to have to accept lower margins than they would like in the short to medium term. And then when times are better, maybe then the margins can increase again.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Trevor Moss, who works out of our London corporate bureau. Trevor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And coming up ahead of next month's U.S. midterm elections, we'll take a look at how pollsters are trying to tweak their public opinion surveys in the hopes of avoiding the notable polling misses of elections past. We'll have that story after the break.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
If public opinion polling is to be believed, control of both the U.S. House and Senate hangs in the balance ahead of next month's midterm elections. But what if the polls this year are as inaccurate as they've been in some recent elections? Well, survey firms say they are taking a range of steps to try and improve the accuracy of their findings. And joining us now with a look at those steps and what they tell us about the key narratives that could decide this year's vote is the Wall Street Journal's Aaron Zitner, who helps to oversee the journal's own polling efforts. Aaron, it's a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, good to be with you.
Aaron, I think people will be generally aware that in some recent U.S. elections, the polls have been way off from actual vote totals. Is there a consensus within the polling industry about what they got wrong?
Well, the problem is that we don't know what the problem is. And that becomes apparent when you look at some of the hits and misses of the last few years. If you go back to 2012, the polls overstated Democratic support and understated Republican support. Barack Obama won by a bigger margin than the polls had suggested. Then we get to 2016, and as we know, we were all surprised, most of us were, by the outcome. The national polls did pretty well, and they predicted Hillary Clinton's victory in the national popular vote pretty closely. But as we all know, the state-level polls missed, and they didn't understand that in individual places, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Donald Trump's support was larger than the polls expected. And that had a huge implication in that he was elected president. So 2016 was a miss on the state level, but not the national level. 2018, the polls did very well. That was a midterm election. Donald Trump was not on the ballot, and that could be material, but he was president. And then in 2020, it was a terrible year for polling. The national polls were way off and understated Donald Trump's support, and the state polls again, like in 2016, understated Donald Trump's support. The last Wall Street Journal NBC News poll before the 2020 election
we really missed on the presidential level. We had Joe Biden winning by a larger margin than he ultimately won by, and we understated Donald Trump's support. But when we asked people in that same poll who they were going to vote for Congress, which party they were going to support, we were really close. How could the same sample produce an inaccurate result on the presidential level, but a close to accurate result on the congressional level? That's one of the kinds of puzzles that pollsters are sorting through to ask, does this problem have to do with Donald Trump? Does it have to do with understating Republican support? Well, in 2012 and 2018, those explanations don't tell us why we had the outcomes we did. So to come up with one model and one fix for all of polling seems really hard, since different things seem to be happening in different years.
And yet some of the pollsters you spoke with for your recent reporting did seem to have some theories about what they got wrong in the past. Detail some of that for us.
Yeah, I know from conversing with Wall Street Journal readers that there is a lot of cynicism out there that polling just can't be fixed. But the pollsters, most of them don't believe it, and they're people of goodwill, and they are trying to get it right. So they're trying a number of things. Their job, by the way, has become harder because of political polarization. Consider that if you're off by a point or two in the share of rural voters, these small misses become more consequential because the country is so much more lopsided in some groups favoring one party and other groups favoring the other.
What tweaks specifically are various pollsters that you've spoken to making this time around to try and improve their forecasts in this election?
Well, I would put them into two buckets. One is new ways to reach the hardest to reach voters, new outreach methods, and then other ways to kind of think about the sample that you collect and who's in your sample. So to reach hard to reach voters, one thing that a number of pollsters are trying is called text to web, where we'll send people a text message and invite them to take the poll online. And just like with the telephone sample, this is a random sample of individuals. Another thing some pollsters are trying to do is to try to kind of build social trust with respondents, to try to signal to people that this is someone who understands the local situation and isn't going to be a biased person coming in from far away. Pollsters are also trying to make sure that they have the right mix of people in their samples. So they're looking at things like voting history, which is a public record. You can see not who someone voted for, but you can see whether they voted and whether they voted in primaries. And if you look at your sample and you see all your Democrats are consistent primary voters, then you've got to believe that you have a very engaged and maybe too many highly engaged Democrats in your sample, and you need more lightly engaged, softer Democrats.
And finally, Aaron, what's the sentiment then going into this election cycle? Is there a sense that the polls maybe are going to have made the right tweaks in order to get this one right?
Well, there's a lot of nervousness that the polls will get it right. And consider also that the situation changes over the course of an election year. So when we talk about polling error, we're really talking about the polls at about this point in the cycle. That's just a feature of polls as snapshots in time and measuring things as they are at the moment. So what we really got to do is look at the polls kind of right now as people are beginning to vote with early voting and are making their decisions, and then look at the election results on election day and seeing how close the polls were at about this point in time.
That was The Wall Street Journal's Aaron Zitner, who helps oversee our polling efforts. Aaron, thank you so much for being with us. Pleasure to connect as always.
All right. Thank you.
And finally, in the words of Elton John, sorry seems to be the hardest word. Though for some in the workplace, sorry seem to be running amok in emails and interactions with colleagues, even when we have nothing to be sorry for. As in, sorry I'm just now seeing your email that you sent 15 minutes ago. Wall Street Journal Work and Life columnist Rachel Feinsig spoke to business experts about this trend and says that even if some believe overusing sorries can hold you back at work, it's a tough habit to break.
Jeff Pfeffer, who's a professor at Stanford, thinks that it gives away your power. It makes you look weak. It can be demotivating to your team, he says, because they want to see you as a leader. I think it can also just grate on some people's nerves. Some people say it can water down the apologies that really count when we're just saying sorry constantly. Then when you really have to apologize for something, it doesn't mean as much. But I tried to reduce my sorries and found that it was really difficult. So I think there is a lot of benefit to some people for using sorry as kind of a social lubricant. But I think there are times when other language can be more impactful because we say sorry so much.
And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.